On this episode of The Dev Team, Mark starts us off by going polymorphic. Then I dive into Rust and Ars Climb on the Toby scale. Finally, Daryl dives into how juniors should approach their senior developers for help in the code.
I'm going to start us off with the word of the day today, and the word of the day that I chose is polymorphism. And so let me kind of start off by giving some real basic definitions of what polymorphism is and where we can kind of use it in programming. So polymorphism, I like to start with kind of the metaphor of the light bulb, right? A light bulb is basically, if I said everyone in this podcast, mail in your light bulbs, and we would end up with all different kinds of light bulbs. We might get, you know, incandescent light bulbs, get halogen light bulbs, get fluorescent light bulbs, get neons, get LEDs, all these different types of different light bulbs. But when we think about a light bulb in general, the goal of pretty much all these things is it takes in electricity and produces light or lumens of some measurement. But how they actually produce that and how the light comes in is actually done in several different ways. How the light bulb handles creating those lumens is different, whether it's, you know, through the heating of the wire or radiating magic particles that I don't understand, quite frankly, or LEDs, which I think I also work on magic. That said, these all function in the same way, but they have a different way of doing it. So polymorphism is a similar kind of idea that says, hey, a piece of code has a similar input and output, but the functionality of it changes. And there's actually two different, polymorphism kind of covers two different things within software development. You have dynamic polymorphism and static polymorphism. Static being when we look at something in like C#, for example, we have method overloading. Method overloading is a form of polymorphism, static polymorphism. And that basically, if you're not familiar with method overloading, it's that in C#, I can have a method named the same, but if its arguments are different, whether they're different in number or different in type, it accepts that. And that is in runtime, I'm sorry, during compile time, it determines based on the input variables or whatever, which of these methods should be called. On the flip side of that, we have dynamic polymorphism. And dynamic polymorphism actually comes from inheritance, which is another concept. But when a class inherits another class, and it can actually override the methods of that parent class, the derived class overrides the base class methods. In the same sense that, you know, if I have animal and animal has speak, and then from animal I inherit cats, dogs, birds, they all can speak, but they could override speak to have different functionalities and different methods.
Yeah, so polymorphism, that's a big, heavy topic, right? And it's one of those things that I think a lot of, especially I'm going to, you know, air some of my own fears and concerns, especially from my earlier days of a junior developer programmer. Polymorphism was one of those things that it was like, you know, I'd hear the seniors talk about and be like, I have no idea what the heck this thing is. What do you even mean? Like, and it was terrifying. And I would read these really confusing blog posts and articles on, you know, polymorphism and what is it and breaking it down and when you should be polymorphic. And it can be a daunting, just the word itself can be daunting to kind of understand,
fun to say.
Right? It is fun to say, right? And I sometimes think that, you know, maybe cruel senior developers start with that whole, you know, let's throw words out there to confuse our junior developers. And I mean, that's not real, but I can sometimes feel that way for sure. And so kind of thinking about polymorphism, especially in languages like JavaScript, does it even really truly exist there?
You know, I think it depends on how you use it, right? Because even JavaScript, you have extends and you can use classes with the ES6 syntax and adjust things there. But ultimately, it's more of, and I wanted to bring it up more of like, should you use this? Why do you use this? When do you use this? And I think that, you know, understanding the concept more of, again, that the dynamics and the statics and things allow for that to be a little more diverse, right? Whether it's you're dynamically doing it with the overloads is probably where I'd see it most likely in JavaScript, is classes can have, or methods could have multiple different implementations in a sense.
Right. So it would be safe to say that maybe you're using polymorphism in conjunction with like the substitution pattern and things of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I think you can kind of think of it from the functional sense that JavaScript lends there, right? If you go purely functional, you can look at kind of the parametric or whatever you call it, polymorphism. I don't really care what data type I'm taking in. I can write a very generic function and evaluate that however I need to, still have those multiple inputs, not really care about them, and still put the same thing out. So from a functional standpoint, I think it still exists in there, but maybe not the same thing that, or the same way that we think about it in C# and true object oriented.
Right. Yeah. I think in a purely functional programming state, especially these dynamic languages that don't support, you know, types in general, it's very difficult to idealize or kind of conceptualize what even you know, what even is a type, or to let alone to be polymorphic, right? When you have the type any, you know, it can be very, very difficult to just even conceptualize what this is. But you know, in a language like C# or Java, you know, these more strictly typed languages, you know, it's a very crucial concept for something just as mundane as creating a list of items, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that that's ultimately one of the reasons I chose polymorphism is it's one of those things that a lot of juniors and a lot of self-taught developers understand the concept, and they know, you know, okay, just like you're talking about with a list, like I can use inheritance to create a list of, you know, animals in the example I gave earlier, but you may not connect the dots that, oh, okay, because those all inherit from animal, whether they're a cat or a dog or whatever, I can put them in this list. And, you know, that even gets into further like Liskov substitution principle. But that said, those are like buzzwords that are thrown out there in interviews. And it's good for, you know, a junior to understand that, you know, this is that thing that you're already doing. That is polymorphism.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm being polymorphic because I have the most basic concept of inheritance. And yes, I do know how to use a list in C#, right? Yeah, I would agree 100%, you know, and sometimes we fall into that hole of thinking something should be more complicated than it actually is, you know, and yes, truthfully, under the hood, computer science and most of these programming languages work because of something like polymorphism, but the actual implementation of really truthfully can be just incredibly mundane. All right, so kind of switching gears just a little bit, I want to talk today about in the news the Toby, and I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Toby or if that's even how you're
Toby
actually supposed to Toby, how you're supposed to pronounce it, the TIOBE scale or index for popular programming languages. And this is not necessarily to say that these are popular because developers enjoy these languages, but these are just very employed programming languages. The Toby Index is designed to help companies say, you know, what technologies should we be using because they're most likely going to be supported, and there's most likely going to be developers out there that actually know how to work with these languages, right? And so this is, it's an important thing for companies to kind of make a decision about, you know, what tech stack are we even going to be using, right? And so, interestingly enough, one of the things that is kind of amazing is the programming language Rust. And I'm not sure, you know, how much we necessarily use that here, especially at CodeWorks. It's not necessarily one of our key focuses or anything that we particularly teach, but it is a very nice programming language. It has a lot of benefits. But what's really, truly remarkable about this is the jump that we've seen in just a year. Rust is about 10 years old and was sitting, you know, pretty low on the list of popular programming languages. And in a single year's time, it has jumped up to, I think it's now in the top 10. I think I was going to double check this. It is now, oh, I'm sorry, it's in the top 20 now. It's jumped to position 18, whereas last year it was down somewhere in the 40 range, which is just absolutely crazy in jumping scale for different programming languages. It's not uncommon to see like a 2% climb, but this had like an 18% climb over the last year. And so that's really just kind of interesting to me and kind of wondering why, right? Like, why has a single programming language jumped that much? And a lot of it, I think, comes down to just its usability and where it can be written and performed. Rust, primarily in and of itself, is kind of more based towards a systems programming language, but we are starting to see it even leak into the world of web development, right? Which just is kind of fascinating in and of itself.
You see this a little bit with Python, right? Python became like a top 10 out of the blue. And I think the biggest reason for that had more to do with the non-web development use. It found a lot of use in some of the sciences, right? I'm a geologist and I have to put together big data. What can I use where I don't have to learn like a robust and heavy and I have to understand all these concepts and principles of a programming language? And that's where Python was. Now, Python has evolved since then and it's more established in some of those other principles. But early on, it was absolutely more of that, hey, how can I write a simple language for non-developers to handle big data?
Yeah, there's a big difference between needing to be able to build an application and needing to be able to crunch heavy numbers, right? And that's actually an interesting thing that you bring up specifically Python, because Python for the last, it's been 9-10 years, has been heralded as, you know, the data science programming language. However, our programming language has also just skyrocketed in popularity. And we're starting to see a lot of kind of data scientists lean more into the R language in and of itself. R is up to, I think, position 8 on the TOBY scale, which is also just like fascinating to see just, maybe Python might actually someday get dethroned. You know, I don't think it's anytime soon, but it is something that do pay attention to.
And maybe that's what's happening kind of with Rust there, is I know it's competing in like the same areas as like what you're saying with C++. And one of the things, I have limited experience with Rust. Of course, I built a video game with it, followed
of course,
a little
right?
tutorial.
That's how you learn any language, right?
That's how I learned anything. Any task I take on, I immediately try to build a game with that thing. But what I noticed is it provides a lot of like kind of that memory safety while still not having to use garbage collection and things of that nature. So it was a little more, I don't want to say efficient, but it was a little nicer to write with than having to handle all of that myself and do all that safety checking and everything.
Yeah,
so.
I think it's definitely a more approachable language than C or C++. And it's, quite frankly, it's a lot more fun to write. And one of the things I do really specifically like about Rust is the non-operator, which is a common thing that we run across in pretty much any programming language, is the null condition, right? Or the not defined. And it's just absolutely awful to get those runtime errors where, you know, you're expecting some sort of object and what you get is null or undefined or nil or one of those terrible words, right? With Rust in particular, you're pretty much forced to handle the non-condition. And so you're not going to get this random, program failure or program crash because you've handled the non-condition and it's forced in the language itself, which lends a lot into that safety typing. So,
do they provide something similar to like the what we would call maybe the Elvis operator?
The Elvis operator. The non is actually a keyword. That you have to, it almost like you would have like a switch statement, right? And so you would have, in the event that the object or the parameter is the thing that I'm expecting, let's define the type because it is a type-based language. So you're going to handle, yes, this type is defined. And then on the very next line, you're going to say non, right? And then you get to handle the non-condition, which is really pretty neat, actually.
Yeah, I think that was exactly what I was like, man, that is so much nicer.
Right. It's actually, it's comforting from the developer standpoint, especially if you are going to be building something that is a systems based, right? Like you can't just have your operating system crash. Like that's not good, right? And so, yeah, it's a really neat, and I'm excited to see where kind of Rust and R actually go in the next year. I think it is safe to say that either Rust or R will most likely be the MVP for the 2020 languages.
I think that, and that's, you got to see that, yeah, most improved even too, right? That big of a jump is significant, and it's not something you can completely ignore. Because you have some of those top contenders, and I'm just guessing here, but you're going to be seeing still, the JavaScripts, the Javas, the C#, some of those industry standard languages that have established at this point still.
Yeah, the like famous top five, rarely ever fall down from that position, right?
But it's always interesting to see what's going on in that lower 20, right? And, there's all the time languages get dethroned. Essentially, at one point in time, the world was run by Visual Basic. And everyone's like, oh, this is amazing, right? But that ship has sailed.
It's funny that you actually bring that up because Visual Basic
don't
is
tell me
still
they're coming
actually,
back.
According to the Tobii scale, Visual Basic is still number 6 on the list.
Wow.
Right? Which is actually kind of funny because the Tobii scale kind of does fall under some scrutiny for sure. So then you end up with the People scale or the Popular scale, right? The PYPL. And, you know, it's very funny to see just kind of the differences in those lists because, you know, Python still, you know, is at the top of the list. But, you know, number 2, you have Java and then JavaScript and C#. And these are this scale, the People scale is more leaning towards like the popularity of the programming language according to developers. Like, what do we want to write? What, you know, and that may be a little bit more appropriate scale for some people, especially when trying to consider the tech stacks is, you know, just because we are writing in Visual Basic, it doesn't mean that we want to be writing in Visual Basic,
absolutely
right?
Absolutely not. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, you know, I love writing in Visual Basic and I wouldn't write in anything else.
You know, despite being, you know, one of my baby languages, Visual Basic, no, I do not enjoy writing in that language.
I think that's what you're exactly looking at there is these are scripts and things that we're maintaining still and just have not bothered. There's so many of them that they just have not been ported over to something else or rewritten in something else.
And yeah, certainly
you're not going to get away from having legacy code.
No.
It could be certainly cost prohibitive, right? That's the biggest thing. That oftentimes when you see that legacy code, right, it's in some sort of crazy monolithic application for some huge company, right? A while ago, you know, I worked for a local healthcare company, and it's the second largest employer in our state outside of the state itself. And they always had that concept of such a big ship to turn. So, you know, while we might see these rapidly becoming super popular languages, it'll be interesting to see if they really actually impact the industry, because you have so many companies like that that's like, cool, great, it's a cool new language, but if it ain't broke, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not going to shift that, right? One thing that is interesting and I think the most important thing to really truly pay attention to is the language maintainers, right? Something like Visual Basic, where Microsoft has specifically said, hey, we're deprecating the entire language. We're no longer going to support it. We're no longer going to release updates. It's time to jump ship, right? Because the language itself by the maintainers is dying. Now, that has happened in the past, of course, and you know, languages have gone like open source and things of that nature. And yes, the open source community does occasionally adopt these things. But if you have a big company like Microsoft who chooses to abandon a language, it's probably time to start paying attention to that.
I think lastly, on kind of on that note a little bit, since the majority of our listeners are going to be junior developers, I think it's good to pay attention to things like this, because if you do see, you know, a job or you're looking at jobs and they are writing in a language that's like rapidly tanking, consider that, right? Do you want to go start your junior time, which is going to be the time you are most flexible and going to learn the most and take in the most, learning a dead language?
Yeah, I think that's a question that could fill an entire podcast session, right?
Absolutely.
And I think that there's definitely some benefits to learning those older languages, learning those older patterns. Is that where I would spend my time as a junior? Probably not, right? I also think it's important to point out that just because a language is rising in popularity, you know, Rust is a super cool language, but it is a systems language, right? If you are a brand new web developer, there is absolutely zero reason for you to go try and pick up Rust right now, or something like R, right? If you're not looking at data scientist level of things, then why would you waste your time trying to learn R when, quite frankly, what you're going to be employable in is something like JavaScript, HTML, CSS, you know, those things are your bread and butter languages, right? And, you know, pay attention on the side to some of these other things that are rising in popularity, or if you have a big interest in kind of changing focuses, then sure, go learn those languages for that specific job. But, you know, don't bail on JavaScript or PHP just because R like is popular. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I look at is, well, look at the SaaS industry, the software as a service is exploding. And so I'm probably more likely to kind of look that route rather than to go back the other way. Everything's moving to that platform. I'd be worried about, you know, caging myself into something that's kind of starting to die off or maybe shifted in a different direction.
Yeah, it comes back to that, like, right, I think any anybody, the popularity contest of like what's popular versus what's actually used, right? And that's maybe not in this particular case, but oftentimes you see like that there's rapid changing among like what language would you like to use? Because all of us are like, oh yeah, I want to try that new and sexy language, right, that everyone's talking about right now. But again, it becomes what is employable. And so you have to find that balance.
Yeah, absolutely. On another completely random and side note, not sure if you guys saw this, but it is a newsworthy topic. Just is happening today, or the announcement was today. One of the oldest businesses on the internet was actually purchased today for, I think it was like $9 billion or something of that. Any guesses as to which company that would be?
Oldest.
One of the oldest businesses on the internet.
I have a guess, but I'm not going to say it out loud, so...
Don't want to be on air with it. So actually, funny enough, eBay is actually being purchased, and we don't know for sure if, you know, eBay is going to actually be maintained as an individual website or not. But it looks like they're actually getting consolidated by another company, undisclosed this time. But announcement, right? The big giant eBay.
There's a small fear in you that there's another big. We'll just say Alphabet company buying eBay.
Yeah, I don't believe it's Alphabet by any sense of the imagination. I mean, I'm sure we'll see something over the next couple of days. But yeah, just it's funny to see a big giant company, something like eBay, actually being acquired and potentially merged or gone. The famous name of eBay might actually be dying. So kind of weird.
I'd make a bet to one of the, you know, like PayPal or something like that. One of the purchasing
payment platforms or something
of
that nature.
Payment platform of some kind going, hey, let's extend into this a little bit. Here's a great start.
Right. Here's a great purchase of $9 billion.
Is that what we're doing now, though? We're gonna take bets on who we think it is?
He has to guess, so...
He has to guess. My other guess would potentially be, so I was actually thinking, I hope maybe not Amazon, right? Because now we're really narrowing that marketplace of places to shop. So Amazon makes sense why they might essentially buy out a competition if they are planning to shut it down. But I can also see even foreign Amazon worthy or Amazon sized companies. You know, you have like the Alibabas and stuff.
Yeah. No, I don't know. If I have to make a guess, I'm going to say it's some company we've probably never heard of, right? It'll be some sort of shell company or something of that nature. And who knows where the actual, you know, chain will go. But yeah, just weird topics, right?
All right, kind of diving into the deep dive today. Asking for help as a junior, okay? Kind of tips and tricks on maybe going about that and things to think about before you do go ask for help, I guess, would be one of the big topics. The first thing I kind of think about is make sure you are escalating through kind of your resource tree correctly. Never go directly to your senior and go, hey, this isn't working. You know, there's some little red squigglies here and, you know, stuff just isn't working.
Yeah, let me tell you, one of my number one pet peeves, right, is, hey, senior, can you solve my syntax problem? Like, that's what IDEs are built for.
Absolutely. I don't think I ever say that enough as a teacher, you know. Hey, maybe don't bring that to your senior, you know. Put a little thought into it first. It might sound cruel to say, but, you know.
I think that that's definitely a part of the learning process too, right? Like, absolutely. You can't just ignore your IDE, right? It's now given sometimes it's wrong, right? Especially in languages that aren't type saved like JavaScript. And it's like, I have no idea what this is. And you'll run into those and it's like, well, there's an error here, but it's not a real error. But outside of that, I think that you need to trust your IDE in that sense. And those syntax errors become that very much you are, oh, well, this is a brand new junior problem. Don't bring me something as simple as, you know, oh, it's obvious that this should have been pluralized.
Right, you're missing an S. Like, that's not a senior-worthy question, right? I think is what you're getting at there. I think one of the things to really focus on is, and remember, is it's my job as a senior to actually help you, right? So don't be afraid to ask me questions, but make sure that you're coming with, I think, something kind of prepared. What I like to see is, you know, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I've done. This is maybe why I think it should work this way. However, I'm running into an issue. And what exactly is the issue? And have you done anything to say, I could solve it doing X or I could solve it doing Y? I don't know what the best approach is. I love those questions because now we get to actually, you know, talk about how we should go about solving this problem. And, you know, we may even say, well, yeah, that's, you know, X, Y. And quite frankly, I think you should solve it using Z, something you haven't maybe thought of yet. But if you've brought me those first two ideas already, that may be jogging something in my own mind to say, oh, well, yeah, those are good approaches. However, let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Even as the senior, you know, I have to have some sort of established common context with you, or I still have no clue what you're trying to solve. I can't give you any answers.
I think to bring it back to what you kind of were originally saying there, though, that chain, right, of yes. What is the chain of responses? I think, you know, obviously syntax problems or your IDE should be the first line of defense there. But beyond that, like before I've gone to the senior, I hopefully have at least if it's throwing an error message, especially, I've Googled that error. Like your Google foo becomes a part of your tool belt. Being able to have good searching becomes very much a part of being a developer, where it's searching Stack Overflow or Google or whatever to just basically suss out what that is. And then, in my opinion, after Google is your peers.
Yeah. If you haven't at least copy and pasted from Stack Overflow to say, did this solve the problem? Then,
I don't know why that works now. That is step number one, right?
I think step number two is also don't just copy and paste something randomly from Stack Overflow and say, it's throwing an error and I don't understand it, right? Like, I don't understand it either. I have no idea what you even Googled to get to that Stack Overflow question, right? So don't just paste in those blobs and expect them to work. And then when they don't, run to the senior and say, help me, help me, help me. Like, that's not an appropriate way to approach this.
You definitely don't want to escalate to the top of that kind of resource tree where your senior's at. I would say, though, something that maybe even comes before that, though, sometimes you do want to escalate right to the top of the tree, you know? So identify the complexity and the severity of the problem. This appears that I dropped the production database. You know, maybe you do want to go run to the senior immediately.
No, man.
So it's kind of sussing out that how bad is this? You know, what kind of problem this is, kind of like what Mark was saying. If this simple syntax, I better start figuring out how to solve these on my own using my IDE. If it's a fairly big problem that's affecting a lot of people, maybe I want to go bring in that help early and call, you know, uncle right off the bat.
Yeah, and I want to point out that, you know, the seniors were not infallible by any sense of the imagination. A lot of the times I've written something and, you know, say it's some sort of API or some sort of endpoint, and I should be returning a particular piece of data. And yeah, I've been guilty of having errors in my own code. And so if you're trying to solve this problem and you're interacting with a piece of code that I've written and what you're getting out of my code doesn't look right, if you're getting it and you're like, hey, I'm expecting a dog and you gave me a cat, you know, that could absolutely be one of my own errors. So don't be afraid to bring those things to me, right? I think that's one of the things that a lot of juniors fall into that mistake of is, you know, thinking, well, the senior's code is absolutely 100% infallible. And so I guess maybe I'm just going to write this to expect the cat instead of expecting the dog like I'm supposed to. That's not something that you want to do either.
I think I've even been guilty of that. Maybe when I first started, you know, we were trying to something with the units or the lessons, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to update these real quick. He said this would work. Oh, it's gone now. Okay, I try to update this next one. Oh, it's gone now. And after deleting like the fourth or fifth thing, I was like, oh, maybe Jake's code is not doing what he said it's doing.
Yeah,
let me go double check that and ask him. But
the other thing that falls within there is time boxing. In how long you spend with that problem, right? You talk about the severity of the issue being a factor there too. And so, you know, that doesn't mean just maybe it's a severe issue. I should just immediately throw my hands up and say, oh, I have no idea. But it does shorten that window of time boxes. You know, let me spend a smaller period of time trying to fix this. Whereas other problems, it's like, okay, I want you to spend a little bit more time on this. I want you to try and think through this. I want you to come to those two or three different potential solutions before you come to me. But at the same token, the absolute worst thing you could do is not set a time box and spend 4 or 5 hours, a whole day, on a small problem that could have been fixed almost within a minute or two by your senior.
Absolutely. Having just a second set of eyes to look at something is it's so crucial, right? I remember just spending a ton of time on a particular problem, you know, for the life of me, could not figure out what was going on, why this thing wasn't working. And in the end, it turned out I was missing an await. Right. And like, how many times does that happen where, you know, you're so involved in the problem that you can't even realize that, you know, you've forgotten to do something as simple as await an asynchronous call.
consider the value you're going to get out of it, you know, with that time boxing in mind. I know I'm missing some tiny little thing here that I've obviously pored over this a million times and I can't find, and I know it's wrong, and I know that it's going to be something tiny. I'm not going to get any value out of waiting around for an hour trying to still solve this myself. So I'm going to get more value out of going and getting that roadblock quickly removed for me.
Right. And if there's a time where, you know, maybe the senior's not available or everyone's in a meeting, you can't have someone just kind of quickly, you know, jump in with you, move on to something else, right? Don't sit idle. I think that's one of the biggest things is, as a junior developer, find some other problem to solve, right? Like, one of our biggest assets as developers is the fact that we solve problems. So make sure that that's what you're actively doing.
Yeah, you can find somewhere else to add value for sure. That's part of it. I think one of the other big topics kind of on that is maybe identifying useful or efficient debugging skills. I think that's the biggest skill for any developer. And that's probably the thing that juniors will lack the most going into the field. And it's a big portion of how do I know when to escalate this, you know, kind of resource tree. You got to identify kind of why do you think your code isn't working, right? It's easy to just say, well, it's not working just because I know it's not working because it's not doing the thing that I wanted it to do. But you really have to dive in there and say, okay, well why do I think it's not working? I expected to make this call to the database and I'm looking here and, you know, that's obviously not happening in the network. That gives you a nice entry point to kind of isolate some of your code that isn't working or clearly isn't working and what is clearly working.
Right.
I know when I click the button, it's working at least to that point, but maybe not getting all the way to that database call.
I think for sure that's a very important thing. If you're going to come and bring me a question and you can't identify even where in the code it's not working, you have not taken the necessary steps to, you know, use your debugging tools, right? Look at the call stack, kind of step through the code. Use those tools that are at your disposal, right? Most IDEs have them built in as well. So, you know, that's one of the things to always kind of look at that immediate window and say, you know, what do I have scope to? I thought I was supposed to have scope to X and I don't here. That's where my error is. How do I get scope to X? Okay. That's a pretty straightforward problem to solve, right? And a lot of the times, just taking the time to actually step through your code line by line as it's running, you'll solve 90% of the problems yourself.
I think that to add to that, like, I always really encourage juniors to use breakpoints and debuggers and not just like console log here, right? Because that console log here, it's like, cool, great, you reach that point in the code, but you don't even know if you have the data you actually think you do with just that console log. And so, okay, fine. You could say, well, I'll console log the data that I think I should have. And that's fine and dandy and all, but that is just like a quick, I would only ever really use that for the very, 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 very first step of if I have no idea how far it's reaching into the code. I click the button and nothing happens. Okay, well, I know somewhere between the button click and the database call, as your example had, something went wrong. My very first step too, and this drives me crazy when a junior comes to me and they don't have their dev tools open. Like, if you come to me and you haven't even checked if there's an error, now I'm like, okay, come on. You open the dev tools and it says that your click event handler is not registered. Like, okay, I'm not even going to answer this question.
Worst things to see, actually.
I'm going to look at you shamefully until you walk away. But, and that's only kind of true. But obviously, we don't treat our students that way. But if you in the workplace, if you have gotten this job and you are employed, you should at least know how to do that. So never go to your senior without at least having it checked your console to see if there's an error being thrown and narrowed down the scope of here is where the variable is not what it's supposed to be.
I do have that, you know, I guess I would maybe call it a pet peeve. If you bring me your computer and I'm looking and I read you your error and it tells you, hey, your error is on line 19. X is undefined, right? Like, read your error messages, please, 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 please. That's always step number one, like you said.
I would also add that, and Daryl touched on these a little bit, I'm just going to kind of highlight it and wrap it around it again, is being able to ask yourself questions. Just like kind of Daryl walked us through, is being able to say, okay, what happens when I click this button, right? Why do I think that should happen? Let me go look at the code. Where is the first place this interacts? What do I have right now? Why do I have that right now? Should I have that right now? Do I need it right now? All those different, just continually asking yourself questions to better understand everything you're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Why is my code working, right? Is there an error message? Oh, there's no error message. Okay, maybe your code is working. You just didn't tell it to do the thing that you wanted it to do. You didn't make the API call, right? I think that's key. It's something you really have to think about and really walk through, kind of like what you were saying. And even speaking on the debugger there, that's probably one of the biggest questions we always get is, hey, well, you said just throw a debugger in here, but where? If it isn't obvious where, just go with what was the last successful action you took. Do you know that you called that first method off of that button click? Go see if you're sure it even happens there, right? You can start all the way at the beginning. If you're confident that you made the button click and it went through the controller and it did the thing and went to the service, okay, start there. But it's just kind of pick a spot and walk through it and really ask yourself what's happening there, why did it happen, and is it what I wanted to have happen?
The big takeaway from that, I guess, is, you know, step through your code, walk through it, right? I call the, you know, what we're talking about is rubber ducky debugging, right? And don't worry, you may look crazy, you may sound crazy, but I actually highly encourage, especially at a junior level, talk to yourself. There's so much benefit in actually saying aloud the processes or the steps that you're actually taking. Because when you're just kind of thinking in your head, it's so easy to misread something or to think that you're doing something when you're not, right? You forgot a return keyword. Little things like that happen. But actually talk to yourself out loud. There's often times when I can say, you know, hey, Mark, Daryl, I'm doing this thing. I'm walking through. I'm doing X. I'm doing Y.
And this whole time, I have not been paying attention.
And yeah, absolutely. You guys don't even have to necessarily be paying attention to me. And I stumble across the reason why my code's not doing what I thought it should do. Because, oh, right there. Yep, I forgot to actually call this method.
I'm sorry, Perfect. Were you talking to me?
No, don't worry about it. Turn around. Keep your headphones on, right? And don't worry, when you're talking aloud, all of your peers, if you are working in the office, everyone's wearing headphones anyway, so they don't hear you. You know, it's totally fine.
I think the other big thing there, when you do encounter those errors that are going to tell you exactly what you need to do, always follow those. Never ignore those. I think that's one of the other big things that I encounter is they come to me and they're like, no, I'm sure it's this API request. I'm like, well, you have this error here. Oh, yeah, but we've had that for like 2 hours, 3 hours. You know, everything is working fine. Okay, but I am confident that that is going to cause this to have an issue. You cannot make that API request without this happening. And so I think that's one of the other big things there is don't ignore any of your errors, you know, resolve them immediately every time.
I think that brings up a very important thing that we can kind of close on. And that is when you do go to your senior for help, don't argue with them. When they tell you something is wrong, it is probably wrong, right? Don't argue with them, solve the problems, agree. Don't just roll over, of course, like we've talked about, have answers, have ideas, but don't argue. Like, we do know what we are talking about. We do bring a lot of experience.
I think I'll add 2 cents on that for my last little bit too. If I as a senior present you with a solution and I explain to you, hey, this isn't going to work, you know, the approach you're taking on this problem will not solve it. You should do it this way instead. Don't then ignore that and spend another like 2 or 3 hours trying to implement the way you were trying to do it because you think I'm wrong. If I say, hey, that won't work, this will, and you come back to me 2 to 3 hours later and say, hey, so I didn't actually implement your solution. I've still been trying to get this to work. I'm mad.
Yeah, I think one of the things to identify there is often as the junior, the senior may be explaining something, and I may say, do you understand? And if you say yes, and you don't actually understand what we were just talking about, and you don't actually know how to implement something, that's exactly what you're going to do. You're going to go away, think you understand, try to come up with some sort of solution that's not what I suggested, and then when you come back to me, yes, you've failed, right? Yes, you've made us angry type of idea. Don't do that to yourself. If you've taken the time to actually come to your senior with a question, make sure that that question actually gets answered, and if you don't understand the answer, ask for clarification immediately. Don't wait.
Yeah, we're in the business of solving problems. If I tell you how to solve the problem and you decide not to implement it, why'd you ask me?
All right, well, thanks, guys. We're going to go ahead and wrap it up there for this episode of the Dev Team. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at boisecodeworks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from The Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.